Okay, let me... I would like to read for you a scripture. Okay, I have it brought up here on the screen. This is not an ambush. You should be pretty familiar with the Mormon theology around this. So,
help, I'm getting ambushed.
You're getting ambushed, yeah. The apostate son has got this... he's going to snipe you. Okay, this is 2 Nephi chapter 2, verse 22. And now behold, if Adam had not transgressed, he would not have fallen, but he would have remained in the Garden of Eden. And all things which were created must have remained in the same state in which they were after they were created, and they must have remained forever and had no end. Now, this is part of the scriptural basis for the Mormon belief that there was no death and no procreation or no anything else in the Garden of Eden before the fall of Adam. Okay, this is written in the Book of Mormon,
right?
As if this was a real thing. How do you harmonize this Mormon belief that there was the Garden of Eden and nothing died or was corruptible or reproduced or anything else in the world? I mean, it actually says all things, okay? That nothing died or reproduced until after Adam's fall. How do you reconcile that with the modern, you know, so scientific discovery that things have been living and dying on Earth for, you know, a couple 4. Billion years?
4.8 billion years.
Oh, I mean, the Earth existed for that long. Things have only lived for couple billion of those years.
You're right. That's right. Okay. Yeah, first of all, let me mention that not all Mormons say that there was no death before the fall. In fact, most of the Mormons that I've talked with about evolution, they're incorrect in this, I think, but they say that there was death before the fall, otherwise, because evolution and the history of the earth shows us that there was death before the fall. But let's go back and look at it from the viewpoint of the scriptures. We have a scriptural account of the earth being created physically, but an earth that was celestial in the sense that it had no death. And whether it's literal or whether it's metaphor is a question that can't really be answered explicitly. Eve partook of the fruit, then Adam partook of the fruit, and through their actions, the earth became mortal. Well, evolution and the history of the earth, is 2.7 billion years of life on the earth, pertains to the physical earth. It does not pertain to this earlier creation of the earth without death. So after Adam and Eve partook of their fruit, then the earth became mortal. And that's when, at the beginning of that point, is when using the viewpoint of science, the Big Bang would occur and so whatever happened. The 2.8 billion years of life. It was the mortal earth.
You're not talking about the Big Bang. Just to disambiguate here, you're talking about like the creation of the earth, not like the creation of the whole universe, right?
Okay.
You're not saying that Adam and Eve existed and fell in order to cause the Big Bang to happen, right? Yeah, I think you really meant that to cause the existence of life on earth or something. Okay.
Yeah. I use the term Big Bang as sort of a general expression, and it implied the whole universe and not, which is, like you said, something that I don't want to get into that. But my point is that from the viewpoint of the scriptures, this is, again, is only my interpretation. It's not necessarily Mormon doctrine from the church, or many Mormons may not agree with this. But from my viewpoint, as I understand the scriptures and understand science, the earth was created without death in a celestial form of having no, as a physical earth, physical matter, but had no death. Adam and Eve made their decision to have the earth become mortal, and they become mortal. And at that point in time, the earth then was changed to a mortal earth, and it was through evolution and through science that we have an understanding of this change that occurred after Adam and Eve partook of the fruit.
Okay.
So it's false, I think, to try and take studies of science and apply them before the time when Adam and Eve partook of this fruit.
Well, whether
that's metaphor or literal is another question.
I think this is actually what you had written in your little book that you had written before, wasn't it? This idea that Adam and Eve existed, fell, and then maybe went into some kind of like suspended animation for like a couple of billion years or something until evolution had caught up with where they had been in the Garden of Eden. And then we're sort of like woken up and unleashed back into the world that was ready for them. Is that sort of
Well, the suspended.
Am I remembering that correctly?
Almost, not quite. The suspended animation part is just your interpretation of your how you would express it. In the book, I point out that this is a book which is called One Mormon's. What's it called? One Mormon's Belief. No, anyway, I can't remember the title, but it's strictly my own feelings about science and religion. Yeah. Anyway,
it seemed to me it was like your version of Evidences and Reconciliations, if you recall that old book written by Talmage or whoever it was.
It was Widsoe.
It was Widsoe, yeah. That was like your version of Evidences and Reconciliations, right? This was like you're saying, okay, here's a conflict, here's a scenario I think could resolve the conflict. Isn't that what that book was?
Basically, one chapter of the book, yes. Basically, Adam and Eve made their decision. The earth became mortal. And from the viewpoint of from the earth in earth time and earth years, we had 2.7 billion. Well, we really had 4.8 billion years for the life of the earth is the I think the number that scientists give currently. But we don't know how that 4.8 billion years in terms of years or days translates into the whatever time that Adam and Eve had as eternal beings with no death. So I just wanted to get away from the idea of having suspended animation for 2 billion years and then they get woke up again.
Well, let's be explicit.
In the book, I say that yes, in terms of Earth years, that took a long, long time for evolution and the Earth to be developed as science gives us the understanding of it. But from the viewpoint of an Adam and Eve, likely was a very short time. Because they were in an eternal sphere, not in a mortal sphere. And their recollection of time would be based on an eternal fact, eternal system versus a mortal system.
Okay, can we back up for just 1 second, though? I feel the need to kind of interject a little bit of actual science into this conversation for just a moment. And I don't mean that in an offensive way. I know that sounded bad just now, but that's not what I mean. Science postulates that the Earth was in a state where no life existed on Earth, but at some point in the last, couple billion years or whatever, but the conditions for life were there. In other words, there were enough nutrients around, the building blocks that would become life were all there and just like waiting for the first life forms or the first replicating molecules or whatever, whatever was the product of that abiogenesis, which stuck, which is, the creation of life from no life. So let's call it a cell. And I don't know if it was a replicating molecule or what, but let's just say that the first life form was a cell. And we'll just say, it might not have been an actual cell, but let's not be pedantic. For our purposes, it was a cell, right?
Okay.
So you have this Earth, which is... It's got all the conditions that could support life if life existed, and we know that that's true because as soon as life came about, it didn't just die off. It actually took, right? So obviously the conditions that were there to support it had to be there. So we have this Earth that's ready to receive life, but there was no life there. Then the first cell comes about and manages to survive, so that we get more cells. I guess to be more correct, we couldn't say necessarily the first cell came about. The first cell came about that actually survived. Okay. I mean, in theory, we could have had multiple cells come about and die, and so we just didn't descend from them. But the first cell that came about and actually continued to survive to this, as our first ancestor, it comes about, and there's this whole Earth with all this land and all these nutrients and all this water and carbon dioxide and just whatever the chemical composition was of the Earth, there was no life except for that cell. And from that, all other life forms have developed. So it was just a cell, and then it was like a slime, and then it was, who knows what, and then it was a fish, sea sponges, mollusks, whatever, and then the fish crawled out of water, and just all this whole, story of all the different life forms that came from that, but it was nothing but a cell. But in the Garden of Eden, we have Adam and Eve as human beings. Okay, we have fruit, we have all the animals, the story as told in the temple and in the book of Genesis, and I think in the Great Price and so forth, describes the lions, the tigers, the bears, oh my, and so forth, and the elephants, whatever. They describe all these animals that were there. Now, you're saying that all of these things really did exist, but none of them were mortal, as the Mormon scriptures say. And then Adam and Eve fell.
That's not what I said.
And then the earth sort of reverts to a situation where there's nothing but the single cell that you accept as part of this history of the earth according to evolution and abiogenesis. So where's the room in this story for a Garden of Eden with plants and animals and human beings and so forth to exist and then to not exist and come about again through evolution after the fall? I just don't see how you're... I don't see how you're really harmonizing the Mormon scriptures with the evidence that we have through science.
From the viewpoint of the scriptures, the earth existed, and where they had all of these animals is a question that I don't really know.
Well, I mean, but the scriptures say that there was all these animals.
But is that literal or is that a metaphor?
Well, I mean, they even describe, you know, the metaphorical day of creation that each thing came about. You know, there was one day where the plants came about and one day where the animals and the fish and the fowls and you know, the beasts, the creepy crawly and all that other stuff. I mean, the scriptures even go into detail about the order in which these things came about, biologically speaking. So I don't see where you can really justify saying that all these things were just metaphorical and didn't really exist. Well, the scriptures even say the order in which they came about. What kind of a metaphor is that? It seems like a claim of, you know, natural history to me.
Yeah, I just said what I said because I didn't want to get off on a tangent with these animals.
So what you're saying is it's possible that the animals didn't even exist. Well, and what about the plants?
Let me strike that comment because it's getting us off on this tangent. Let's just talk about the earth as being created without death and not worry about the details. From the viewpoint of the scriptures,
I think the devil is in the details here. I mean, evolution, abiogenesis and evolution postulates a very humble origin of like a cell. I'm calling it, you know, a cell or a replicating molecule, then leading to all the forms of life we have now. And the Garden of Eden story, which you say preceded that, had animals and plants and human beings. Unless everything was just a metaphor, in which case, really, the story is pretty useless because it doesn't really tell us anything. Oh, and the devil wasn't really a talking snake, and Adam, you know, Eve didn't really eat a piece of fruit. It was all just a metaphor for something else that we don't know. I mean, it gets to a point where if you write off everything as a metaphor, then the whole enterprise is just absurd.
Well, that's a separate issue. If you write off everything as a metaphor, then you have to look at what is the metaphor trying to teach, and you focus upon that. I think, the earth, what's important to me from the spiritual viewpoint is that Adam and Eve were given the chance. They had to make a decision whether they would remain immortal without death, but also not capable of having children, or whether they would allow themselves to be changed into a mortal condition and the earth to be changed with them into a mortal condition so that they could have children and reproduce and go through all of the trials and temptations of opposites and so forth of mortality. So to me, the important thing of a metaphor is not the metaphor itself, or the important thing of literal interpretation is not the interpretation itself, but what is the basic concept or principle that those things are trying to teach. But going back to the scriptures, we have an earth that was created physically in terms of matter, but I don't want to call it a resurrected matter, but it was sort of a parallel to that because it had no death. Then the earth was changed from this condition of no death to a condition of mortality. And everything that you want to say about scientists' understanding of the earth, with this, you know, the one cell, the slime and so forth, the fish walking on the land, all of those things only pertain to the existence after this, what the scripture referred to as the fall of Adam, this change from an immortal to a mortal earth. And scientists can say nothing about the condition of the creation earlier than that point in time, earlier than the fall.
I don't see where you can say that. I mean, they talk about, you know, at one point in time, our universe, our solar system was probably just a gigantic cloud of gas and dust, right?
You're talking, Seth, you're talking about the physical solar system, which didn't happen until after Adam and Eve made their decision.
The solar system didn't exist before Adam and Eve fell? Not, I mean, we're talking not, about the Earth. Not, I mean,
I'm talking about a mortal solar system, and a mortal Earth did not exist until after they made their decision, and the immortal Earth, the Earth without death, was changed to become a mortal Earth.
So
there's no way scientists have no way of getting knowledge of this immortal Earth.
You know,
it's just as if there's a blank wall, and they can't go past that blank wall with their research.
This is just turtles all the way down, and it just seems like you're going further and further back in time. If I understood you correctly, the solar system itself didn't exist before Adam and Eve fell in the Garden of Eden. Well, scientists understand that the solar system must have formed by the collapse of a cloud of dust and gas into the sun at the center, and, you know, slow accretion or even rapid accretion of dust and gas and so forth to result in all the planets that we have. So you're saying that the Earth didn't even exist until after Adam and Eve made this decision and fell. And
as the cloud of dust collapsed and the Earth accreted
out of dust.
That's right. As we're talking now about a mortal Earth didn't exist. You've got to keep in mind that from this viewpoint that I'm portraying, from my interpretation of the scriptures, we have an immortal Earth which did exist and a mortal Earth which did not exist until, as the scriptures say, the Earth was changed and became mortal through the decision that Adam and Eve made in the garden.
See, this really points out the difference between the two of us, because you and I both know that you can explain the solar system entirely from scientific point of view, and all this God stuff is just tacked on because you're a, you know, 75, right? You're 75 this year, right?
Right.
1935. So you're a 75-year-old Mormon who really has no alternative but to keep believing, and so you have to tack on this God stuff. Right? So Adam and Eve exist on a pre-mortal Earth, and then they fall, and bam, in the blink of an eye, we've got this void of space with a giant cloud of gas and dust, which collapses into our solar system, and the sun comes into existence, and then the Earth accretes in this same sort of plane with all these other planets out of gas and dust and so forth, and is this gigantic ball of lava, and slowly cools down for a couple billion years, and accumulates chemicals and elements from asteroids and from the gas that we were still floating around in the solar system. And then this cell appears in this chemical soup that was able to support it. And bam, 2.5 billion years later, here we are. And all of that happened after Adam and Eve fell. And then we didn't see human beings on Earth again until, you know, 100,000 years ago or so. You see what I'm saying? You're tacking on a bunch of sort of like just hand-waving exercises, like theological hand-waving exercises, onto real science and saying that your science and religion don't disagree with each other. Well, no, they don't, because your religion, your religious understanding and explanation of this is just tacked on to the science. I can't prove that immortal Earth didn't exist, which then disappeared after Adam and Eve decided to eat the fruit, or whatever the metaphor was, decided to fall, and then bam, the solar system came into existence. I obviously can't contradict that. but there's no reason to believe it unless you happen to be a 75-year-old Mormon who really has no alternative but to, you know, somehow excuse away the claims of your apostles and prophets.
Let me explain that last part in my words. There's no reason to believe it unless you're a person who has faith and has chosen to follow that faith in accepting the scriptures as a mainstay of your life, because that's the story that the scriptures teach.
Right.
You can discount that because you don't believe in the scriptures. I do believe in the scriptures, and so I accept it. But the scriptures teach that there was an immortal earth without death, and that Adam and Eve made the decision, and that it was changed, and at that point, the earth became mortal. And that is all of this, all of the research and descriptions from science pertain to that mortal phase, not earlier to the immortal phase.
Okay, so I'll give you the last word on that. I want to kind of make a somewhat related point and then discuss some other stuff. You see in the scriptures a bunch of metaphors which God gave us and if he's only going to give us a little bit, I mean, we got the creator of the entire universe here. He knows an awful lot of things that we would like to know. He had to be very picky and choosy if all we have is the Bible and the Book of Mormon and like that parchment from Moses that Joseph Smith never actually got his hands on but was somehow able to translate. Okay, and the Book of Abraham. Okay, so God was very, very choosy about what he chose to give us as his word, and this is what we get. You know, the Tower of Babel, Noah's Ark, you know, Adam and Eve, which, you know, if you ask most Mormons, means the earth is a few thousand years old, or maybe it's older than that, but God used evolution, and then some hand-waving goes on, and then you still get the Garden of Eden. And then you got you, who got this sort of view of the Garden of Eden that must have happened before the solar system even came into being, and so forth. I mean, nobody seems to know what's going on here, and this is the best God could do. Well, As Sam Harris would like to point out in his talks, every one of us, both of us, could take 30 seconds and improve upon the Bible as scripture. I mean, how about this? How about God comes up with some scriptures and says, here's commandment number one, wash your hands before you eat. Rule number two, boil your water. Number three, sterilize your tools before you cut into each other's bodies and perform the primitive surgeries. Rule number four, be nice to people. You know, rule number five, teach your children to learn how to read and become educated. And you see what I'm saying? I mean, we could come up with an infinite number of ways to result in knowledge from on high that these people wouldn't have known necessarily, which would have immeasurably improved their lives. And instead, we get talking snakes and Adam and Eve eating fruit before the universe, you know, before the Big Bang or the solar system came into existence or whatever. Do you at least understand why someone like me could look at that situation and say it is obviously absurd? It's obviously man-made. Not that you have to agree with me, but can you at least see the logic behind my conclusion?
I do, Seth. This is why I've wanted to talk with you about this from time to time and why we're meeting this evening, because I can understand it to at least to a degree from your viewpoint that these things seem absurd, because You can create almost like what to you is a complete picture of all of these things without the presence of God being there. I include the presence of God.
That makes perfect sense.
That's right.
Exactly. I can come up with a situation that explains all of this away as just the creation of human beings, and it really leaves nothing unexplained. Whereas you come up with all this stuff that includes God in the picture and leaves pretty much everything unexplained. And all the things that we thought were explained, we have to reinterpret as soon as science, you know, comes up with a way to disprove all the previous interpretations.
I believe that God, as I've mentioned several times, that I believe that God works through natural laws. And if you look at just the natural laws themselves, they will give a what seems to be a complete picture without God being there, because there's no, you have, scientists have no knowledge, no way of getting knowledge about God directly. But they do have ways of getting knowledge about how the earth operates and the universe operates and the natural laws and so forth. Once I take the viewpoint that God works through natural laws, then I'm also recognizing that people can take the picture of the natural laws and remove that from God and leave God behind and not need God. And that's very logical and very reasonable for them to do that. In fact, if I didn't have faith in God, I would be right there with them doing that myself. When I read the scriptures, I look at the scriptures from one viewpoint, and that is why. Why did God do this and why did he do that? I don't worry about the how, because I'll let the scientists tell me the how. It's this phrase we had at the very beginning of letting the scientists do science and the church will do the spiritual things. But I look at the why. What is this from the story of Genesis and the creation? What is the why of all of this? Why did God create the earth? Why did he put Adam and Eve in the garden? Why did he, so forth, why, whatever the questions may be. Why were the languages confounded? Why was the story of the Tower of Babel retained among the people, of God confounding the languages? Why did these things happen? What is the why of the flood? I don't worry about the how, because scientists will tell me the how, but I look at the why.
Sure.
And the why is to teach the people to have faith And even though the Jews lost this knowledge, to teach them that Christ would come as the Redeemer and provide the atonement. The story of the Tower of Babel is a story of faith in God and following God. The story of the flood is a story of faith in God and following God. The story of the creation is of the earth being the home of God's children so that they could go through the experiences of mortality. And I don't, as I read the scriptures, I really don't worry about any of these hows anymore like I used to worry about. I go to scientists and I'll let them tell me the how. But I want to gain the why, because this is something that scientists can't tell me is the why, but the scriptures can.
Well, I don't think that the scriptures can tell us the whys any more than science can in a way that I, you know, find believable. I find it kind of offensive that people should say, well, science is going to tell us the how and religion is going to tell us the why. Or science is going to tell us, you know, whatever, and religion is going to tell us, you know, morality or what's right and wrong. I don't think that religion has a very good track record, frankly, of telling us what's right and wrong and what's morality. And particularly if you read the Old Testament, you know, I mean, you were supposed to be stoned for picking up sticks on the Sabbath, or, you know, Israel was supposed to go in and slaughter the Midianites and the Amalekites and the whoever-whatites. You know, anybody who was there when the Israelites showed up was dead meat. And what does God say? Kill all the adults, and of the children, kill all the male children. But if you find any virgin girls, you can keep them for yourselves. You know, it's just not credible for religion to give us these kinds of scriptures and then tell us that they know the whys and that they know right from wrong. I think it's self-evidently clear that we are ethically much better as a civilization today than we were 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago. And that doesn't mean that we have everything right, but I think that we have made an awful lot of progress in ethics. And I think that that is all not just despite, but I think, well, no, I think it is despite religion. I think it's despite religion. I don't think that we get really much of at all of our ethics from religion, and particularly not from the examples of our, you know, the past prophets.
I'm not claiming that all religions will do the things that I've talked about, but I believe that, if I may use the phrase, true religion will. If all people followed the basic teachings of Christ, literally, if all people followed them, you'd have no wars, you'd have no crime.
You'd have no investment. You'd have no savings. You'd have no thrift. You'd have you wouldn't have a home, because you would just give everything up and follow Jesus. You know, why take ye thought for the morrow? You know, consider the lilies of the field. Do they do anything? And look at how wonderfully they are clothed. I mean, Jesus was telling his followers to just drop what they were doing and follow him. If you read that and do it today, you're screwed. And I think it's pretty clear when you read the New Testament that if you take Jesus at the words that are written in his name in the New Testament, he either was mad or he really believed that the earth was about to come to an end. If you read what Jesus was saying to his followers, it only makes sense if he was either crazy or he actually thought the world was about to come to an end. And guess what? It's 2,000 years later and we're still going. What if the early saints had refused to invest or refused to build or refused to plant their crops because they were convinced that next month Jesus is coming back? We only have all the stuff in the state of Utah that the Mormons built up and all of the stuff that you have accomplished in your life because we didn't take Jesus seriously at his word, and you went to college and you did take thought for the morrow and worked hard and bought a house and paid it off. And the Mormons did come out and plant their crops and mine the rocks and build the temples and all this other stuff. They weren't following Jesus's word. They were assuming that Jesus wasn't going to come back.
Jesus wasn't right speaking then to them. You've got to understand, Seth, that when Jesus, like he told the lawyer to give up all of his stuff and to follow him, he wasn't saying that all people should do that. He was giving that as an example that people should follow him and give up their stuff. What do they give up? They give up their attitudes. They give up their private hobbies, computer hobbies, car hobbies, video game hobbies, whatever they may be, and focus upon the spiritual things of life. Jesus never told the Mormon pioneers to not to go to college. I was taught by my parents, and I was taught by my church leaders to go to college.
Right, because so you they can't, weren't you can't, reading the scriptures and following no, Jesus' example.
Because we believe they were. You believe they were.
I think they were following the example of the rest of the world, which is, you know, work hard, get an education, or at least sort of the Protestant world that was created here in the United States after, you know, the Puritans and everybody else came over.
There's nowhere, Seth, that you'll find in the scriptures that they say that we should not go to college. You've got to take the teachings of the scriptures, and through having letter, this is one advantage we feel of having Latter-day Revelation through prophets, is that they can tell us for our time what we should do, as they are spokesmen for God in a general sense.
Okay.
You can't take word for word a literal interpretation of the scriptures and apply it to every age and every group of people, because the scriptures weren't intended for that to be that broad.
Okay.
But this is why we have so many denominations within the Christian world, is because people try to take the biblical scriptures at face value and apply them to the 20th and 21st centuries, and we get thousands and thousands of interpretations, and all of these churches exist.
Okay, so I'll let you have the final word on that. I've been trying to buck the trend that both of us have noticed in our past conversations, where I tend to try to monopolize the conversation and do most of the talking. So I hope you're feeling, you know, like you're being given an adequate hearing. And I mean, do you feel that way?
Yeah, I feel like you've given me a fair hearing, and you've paused and let me express myself. I've gone on for quite a time, and sometimes, so I have no complaints about how this conversation is going.
Okay, well, I'll let you have the last word on what we were just saying. Let's segue into this sort of related topic of prophetic fallibility. Okay, you quoted Joseph Smith earlier as saying that, you know, a prophet is only a prophet when he's acting like a prophet, and so forth. I remember several years ago, you and I kind of having an argument over the phone, and I specifically remember you bringing that up, and I asked, okay, well then how do you know when the prophet is speaking as a prophet and when he's speaking as a man? And I would like to ask you that question again. How do we know that the prophet is speaking as a prophet?
Earlier I mentioned the general authority who said that scientists will take care of the science, and their purpose as leaders of the church is to provide for the spiritual growth of the people. So I believe that when a prophet is speaking as a prophet, he will be speaking primarily about the atonement of Christ and the need that we have of the atonement and the benefits that the atonement can give to us, and then things that can go off on, you know, on the boundary of that. If he speaks about things that are not clearly explained, such as the creation of the earth, the flood, then I interpret that to mean that he's speaking as a man, not as a prophet. To put this in another viewpoint, when I was a missionary many years ago in West Virginia, we were meeting with a minister of the Reorganized Church, and there were a number of reorganized families in that neighborhood, and I knew very little about the Reorganized Church, and so I did some reading on LDS history of that era. And I came across a statement by John Taylor, who at this time he was a member of the 12 and not president of the church, and so I will call him Elder Taylor because he wasn't president yet. But Elder Taylor said that the church is accountable only for what is taught in the scriptures. And he's ignoring, of course, the problem of interpretations. But he said that the church is accountable only for what is taught in the scriptures, and it is not accountable for the statements of any elder.
Well, I think that, so that I is have a total cop-out.
Well,
you know,
you can call it a cop-out, but I've taken that very literally, Seth, that I consider the prophet speaking as a prophet when he wants us to know that we are speaking as a prophet. And he'll do this through letters from the First Presidency that are signed under his signature. He'll do this through statements, perhaps, where it's very clear that he makes it very clear that this is the word of the Lord.
Okay, so
And the one last comment, the general authorities of today have learned by the experience of the earlier generation, earlier decades, that they really need to focus upon the spiritual aspect of their calling and not upon the physical aspect.
They need to keep their freaking mouth shut, right? That's what they've learned, that they just need to keep their trap shut, because every time you go back...
In Brigham Young's time, the apostles were very open to talking about men on the moon, men in the sun, the evils of evolution, whatever. They talked about a lot of things that weren't pertaining to the spiritual growth of the people. And the leaders of today have learned to not do that. So they focus.
You would like to think so. You'd like to think so, except, okay, first of all, let me back up for a moment, because you said, okay, here's this quote that the church is only accountable for what's taught in the scriptures. Well, I would like to point out that no, you're not even accountable for that. Because when the scriptures are proven wrong, you just write it off as metaphorical. So you're not even really being held accountable for what's in the scriptures. So basically, the prophets get to say whatever they want, and the scriptures say whatever they want. And if the scriptures are untestable, then it's accountable to that. We're all accountable for that. If they are testable, okay, you can fudge a little bit and say this is metaphor, but we're going to be accountable for everything else. It's almost like you're creating an unfalsifiable situation. And secondly, I think you're ignoring all the things the church has stated about how authoritative the modern-day apostles and prophets are supposed to be. Okay, so the words of the apostles and the prophets today are supposed to be scripture to us. When you go to conference and they speak, we're told repeatedly that those conference talks are scripture. You know, you got the Ensign magazine.
Who has told you that?
Well, Brigham Young told us that, for one thing.
Well, I discount anything that people in his era have said in terms of things that... No, let me finish. I discount anything that the apostles back in his time up to the early part of the 20th century, when they talk about unknowns, when they talk about things that can't be explained clearly.
Yeah, because
it's not... It's hard for us to tell what is what they were inspired in, what they weren't inspired in, so I just discount all of the... I did pretty much discount any statement they want to make about... things that are not clearly explained, but I accept very much things when they talk about the atonement of Christ and the gospel and spiritual things.
Well, of course, you know, if you go back to Joseph Smith's day, I mean, he was talking to God, you know, every time someone came to his office and said, hey, you know, what should I do? Oh, thus saith the Lord, you should go on a mission. Should I, you know, ride a horse or take the ferry? Thus saith the Lord, I don't give a care whether you ride the ferry or take a horse. You know, blah, blah, blah. You have 130-something sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, half of which are like, and to you, my servant, Frederick, you know, B. Granger or whatever, I say, tie thy shoe, you're about to trip. You know what I'm saying? It's the Lord telling people like very, very specific stuff where you wonder, why is this even in the scriptures? It's like the Lord telling this guy one very specific thing that only applied to him, and yet we can't get like actual proclamations from today's prophets into the scriptures, but Joseph Smith told some guy to like sell his farm or whatever, and there it is. I mean, I'm making that up. I don't remember. You know what I'm talking about, though. I mean, the Doctrine and Covenants is like filled with these, you know, ones where someone's even addressed by name and told something specific, right? Joseph Smith was getting revelation for people all the time. You know, he claims he saw God the Father, Jesus Christ, Isaiah, the Apostle Paul, Moses, John, you know, Peter, James, and John, John the Baptist. I mean, you name it. I probably have left out like 20, you know, historical characters from the Bible or the Book of Mormon or whatever that Joseph Smith is claimed to have seen. These guys were used to speaking authoritatively. When Joseph Smith said, thus saith the Lord, you believed, if you were Mormon back then, that God just whispered this into his ear. And when Joseph Smith came to some girl and said, the Lord told me that you're given to me as my secret plural wife, I mean, these women took it for granted that God in heaven just told Joseph Smith to do this. Okay, these guys were used to that kind of authoritative speaking, right? And so is it really any wonder that Brigham Young would get up and say stuff and know that the church would just assume that he was talking to God? Well, I mean, what's the precedent? Joseph Smith has a precedent. He was like the prophets of old. I hate Joseph Smith in a lot of ways. I really do. because the Mormons today make Joseph Smith out to be like the best guy that ever lived, and I think the guy was a scumbag. I mean, he was probably a good guy in a lot of ways, and he was a scumbag in a lot of other ways, okay? But at the very least, when he stood up and told you, yeah, I have seen God. What does Boyd K. Packer say? Oh, some things are just too sacred to talk about. What a scumbag that guy is. He won't even tell us whether or not he's seen God. He's like, oh, I'm a special witness of Jesus Christ. I'm just like all the apostles of old, and I'm the, you know, these ecclesiastical successor to Joseph Smith and all these other people who saw these marvelous visions and had visitations from heavenly being. But I'm not going to tell you whether I've had any of these things, because unlike Joseph Smith, for whom it was not too sacred to talk about, my experiences are. Well, that's bullcrap. It really is.
It was important, Seth, for Joseph Smith to have visions of those various personages that you've mentioned, because the keys of the priesthood were being restored and the foundation of the church was being laid and the revelations were being given to clarify from what the Catholics and the Protestants were doing. Today, we don't need that level of vision because those
Says
things...
You. Why don't we need Well, look, tell me.
We don't need to have Peter, James, and John come to you, Seth Lay, or to me, Alan Lay. We don't need to have Elias and wherever the prophets where they came to Joseph.
Please say Elijah and Elias. I want to hear you say it.
Elijah and Elias.
As separate beings. Do you know why I'm asking you to say that?
Why?
Because Elijah and Elias are the same thing. One was the Greek word and one was like the Hebrew word. And Joseph Smith got that wrong because he didn't know the difference when he described those as two separate beings. I mean, it's really kind of funny, actually. I just wanted to hear you say it just so I could, like, rib you about it later on. But anyway, go ahead.
What I'm trying to say is that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, they lived in a period of time when the foundation of the church was being revealed and established. The keys of the priesthood were being revealed. Today we have those things. And our challenge is not to receive the keys of the priesthood or the foundation of the church, but it's to act upon what we have. There are a lot of bishops and a lot of state presidents, a lot of general authorities who are inspired and who will talk to their people from the viewpoint of inspiration. Why is this not recorded? Why should it be recorded? I don't see any need for it to be recorded. It was important, even though Frederick, whatever his name was, to take a train and go to here or there or whatever the story may be that you are illustrating. Behind that literal aspect of he doing those things, behind that was the idea that he should be obedient to God. And this is why I think that those things were included in the Doctrine and Covenants, is because the message that they gave, in addition to the superficial message that so-and-so should do such-and-such in his personal life, but there was the message of obedience to God and obedience to the leaders of the church and following them. So those things were retained in the Doctrine and Covenants to teach those basic messages. Today we were encouraged to keep our journals today, and hopefully people put into their journals specifically and clearly the spiritual experiences that they have had. It's not given in scriptures to the church as a whole, but it's given as quote-unquote scriptures to that person.
By the way, I'm going to ask you a question here, and I'm asking because I don't remember who it was. Do you recall several years ago, I think it was David B. Haight, but I'm not sure, who actually got up in conference and told this story of when he was like in a coma? Do you remember that? He was like deathly ill, and he was unconscious, and he had some kind of vision, and it involved a sighting of Jesus Christ, and there was some more detail that he put in there. I guess he saw Jesus on the cross or something like that. I don't remember. Do you recall that?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, this was actually in the last, I don't know, the last 10 years, let's say, because it's fuzzy enough in my mind. I don't remember any more than that. Maybe somebody on the forums or somebody will give us the citation. But basically, one of the apostles was deathly ill and had this vision while he was unconscious, and actually gave it in a talk mentioned this in a talk in general conference. And I just think it's the funniest thing, and I'll tell you why. Because you have Boyd K. Packer on the one hand saying, we're not going to tell you if we see God because some things are just so sacred we never talk about it, wink, wink, nod, nod, so that the faithful Mormons would read into that, yeah, we see Jesus all the time, and, you know, we know things. Every time we look at you, our eyes are boring into your soul because we have all these magical powers because we're, you know, apostles and we see Jesus and stuff like that. Yeah, so the faithful Mormons believe this, but he's not actually claiming that he saw Jesus, and he's telling you that they're not going to tell you because it's such a sacred thing. And yet, the first apostle that actually does have something like a vision, you know, in like while he's in a coma in his deathbed, where he claims to see Jesus in this vision while he's unconscious, bam, he stands up and talks about it in conference. And I'm thinking, really? So why wasn't that too sacred to talk about? All right, so this guy was in a coma and had a dream or a vision, and so he sees Jesus admittedly in a dream, not in a physical way, and he's going to tell us about it, and all the Mormons are going to be like, ooh, see, we told you he saw Jesus. He had a vision given to him. All right, I want to know if Jesus appears in the Salt Lake Temple. I mean, is there any truth to the rumors that there's like some special room that the prophet goes to in order to talk with Jesus? Oh, that's too sacred to talk about. Bull crap. It wasn't too sacred to tell us about your dream you had while you were in a fever. It wasn't too sacred for Joseph Smith to tell us, you know, 10 or 15 years after the fact that he'd seen God the Father and Jesus Christ in the third or fourth version of his first vision story. I mean, it wasn't too sacred for any of the apostles and so forth in the prophets in any of our scriptures to tell us that they had seen the burning bush or heard the voice of God or saw God's finger touching the stones or any of these other things. And yet in our day and age, it's too sacred to talk about. Well, I think it's pretty transparently obvious that that none of these guys are seeing Jesus ever. But they can't just come out and say that because so many Mormons think that they do, that if they do come out and admit, yeah, I've never seen any of these things, then you're going to have people losing their faith. In fact, I remember Gordon B. Hinckley was kind of pressed on this in an interview. I can't remember if it was the one he did with Mike Wallace or the one he did with like Larry King or something. And he was asked right out, have you seen God? And what has Gordon B. Hinckley said? I felt his presence. Well, that the way he said it could be read in a couple of different ways. The true believing Mormons are going to be like, okay, he's talking to someone in the world who just wouldn't understand, so he's going to downplay his interactions, but he's not going to say anything untrue, but he's going to downplay it so as not to cast his pearl before swine, but we know that, of course, he really has. But in reality, he's telling you, no, I haven't seen him. I felt his presence, which is no more than every other Mormon who claims to, you know, to have had a spiritual experience could tell you. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that these guys are saying that any one of us couldn't have experienced. And yet they're not going to just come right out and say, yes, we have, or no, we haven't seen Jesus. They're just going to let the faithful keep believing that they have. And I think it's such a con. Anyway, go ahead. I bloviated for a couple minutes there.
I have no comment to make other than, you're obviously, Seth, you're welcome to have your opinion and interpretation of this. Why those brethren didn't be more explicit, you'd have to ask them.
Sure.
Unless I get my names confused, Brother Haight has passed on, so you may have to wait until the next life to ask him. But you may have to ask them, you'd have to ask them why they took the viewpoint they did in terms of these spiritual experiences.
Have you noticed that in this entire conversation so far, my positions seem to really leave not much unexplained and be very parsimonious in the sense that they seem to answer the questions with the least imposition of unsubstantiated claims, whereas you seem to have the beliefs which require the most hand-waving exercises. And every time you say, well, I believe this because of faith, I mean, that really is kind of like a big hand-waving exercise. You say, I believe in science, and I believe in all the same things that you believe in, and then on top of that, I attack a God, and I have no other justification for that than that I believe and have faith, and then you wave your hands a little bit, and a little bit of woo-woo noises are heard, and those are your reasons. And I think that that's not nearly as parsimonious as mine.
You have a point. I can't disagree with what you said. I mentioned several times that I believe that God works through natural laws, and that if those natural laws were taken away from God, they would give a pretty much a complete picture of what's going on. And a person who didn't believe in God could look at that picture and say, "Well, this is it. There's no God here, and this is what happened." And that's what you're doing. I take the additional step that I have faith in God, and so I say that God is behind the scenes and working with these natural laws.
As we near the end of this conversation, I kind of wanted to make a point here, and I'll kind of wrap that up with a bit of a thank you in a way. I'll get to that in just a moment. Okay. I wanted to remark that your kind of faith, in my opinion, is the kind of faith that's basically set up for generational failure. And what I mean by that is I don't think that your faith that you have personally is the kind of faith that you could expect to last for more than just one generation. In other words, when you die, you're going to take all that with you, and it's not going to be inherited by the next generation. And I mean, institutionally, if the church were to adopt your version of Mormonism, I don't think that the church would last more than one generation. And the reason why is that it doesn't add anything. I mean, like I pointed out, you're perfectly willing to say, okay, I'm going to buy the scientific version of all of these explanations. And then on top of that, I'm going to tack on this sort of arbitrary religious claim that isn't really motivated by any evidence or any logic or rationality. It's just, you know, a bunch of sort of post hoc defenses against, you know, scriptural metaphor and non-factual scriptures and like contradictory statements by past prophets and everything else. And I just really don't think that you're adding anything of value on top of the naturalistic explanations. Your version of everything is exactly the same as my version, with a bit of God tacked on top. And since that God isn't motivated by any reason, it's superfluous. It doesn't do anything for people, and I don't think it's a recipe for success long term for a belief system. I think that for the belief system to last hundreds and hundreds of years, it has to make some pretty strong claims, and it has to provide some pretty strong answers. And the churches that have lasted for a long time do make all these claims. Even the Mormon church doesn't really believe what you believe. You have like your own version of Mormonism that, you know, the apostles and the prophets, they the Mormon church today in that recent Pew study that came out a few months ago, I mean, more Mormons disbelieve evolution than pretty much every other religion out there except for like the Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, evolution, and I know that this is probably true because just anecdotally in my own, not family in terms of like my side, like you and mom and Chad and my sisters and stuff, but like in my wife's family, I mean, of the siblings of my wife's who are still faithful in the church, I think they all believe that evolution is a pile of crap. It just seems that wherever I look, I see Mormons who just reject the science, unlike you, but the Mormon church as a whole, like the chapel Mormon that Dr. Shades likes to talk about, still is kind of like science deniers and scriptural literalists and stuff like that. I think they have to be. And if they ever give that up, I think the church is doomed. And, you know, that'll be the church's last generation, is the one that adopts a faith like yours.
You're right in saying that when I die, my vision of things will go with me. That's true. Because I'm not the prophet. I don't speak for the church. And the ideas that I have are just strictly my own ideas. And so when I die, they go with me. Whether or not the church will disappear if it were to adopt to accept more a scientific viewpoint and like evolution and less a literal interpretation of the scriptures is something that I can't say. I don't know. I do, as a personal belief, of course, I do believe that as time goes on, that more people in the church will realize that the scientific approach has value and that they will not discount it per se, because they will realize that the narrow vision that they have had of things in terms of the creation and evolution and the flood and so on comes from a very narrow, very literal interpretation of the scriptures. And I believe as time goes on that people will realize that the scriptures were never intended to be taken that literally and that narrowly. And so that this broader picture will emerge as the predominant belief in the church. But, of course, this is only my own viewpoint, and it's biased, of course, by that's how I feel.
Since
that's how I feel, that's how everybody has to feel, because my way is correct, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Just joking.
Exactly. No, I understand.
I think that the things you've said about the church people in general not accepting evolution is very true. And whether or not the church will remain because of the people remaining that way, or whether the church will continue to remain if the people of the church change and accept a more broad-minded or more liberal interpretation, I don't know. I can't say on that.
Okay, so I guess
you're very true that Mormons in general do have this very literal interpretation of things.
If you have a situation where even the apostles and the prophets and like most of the church members sort of disbelieve the science and believe in this scriptural literalism and denial of evolution and things like that, and they're wrong, well, why doesn't the prophet go to God and ask? If these guys are really talking with the creator of the entire universe, they could find this stuff out in like 5 minutes. So why don't they?
Maybe they have gone to God. I don't know, and you don't know. We don't know what discourse the prophet of the church has had with God, but we do know that the church hasn't changed its course, which I feel means that these things such as the creation and the literalism of the flood and whatever are not really important. The important thing is the atonement of Christ and the are living the gospel and doing what we can to be like Christ and to follow him and as true disciples of him. And looking at my life over the past 50 years, there has been almost a complete overhaul of the church in terms of this attitude towards the atonement. I grew up thinking that the gospel was the preexistence, the Book of Mormon, the Bible, a missionary work, but there's no talk about Christ. There's no talk about the atonement of Christ. There's no talk about being true disciples of Christ and letting him be our mentor and our example in life. But since that time, literally, a revolution has occurred in the church looking more at what I consider the important spiritual aspects of the church and forgetting these other details that are interesting but not really critical to our salvation. So I think that the church has had this revolution.
Sure. So basically your answer to my original question is the whole it's not relevant to our salvation.
You mean in terms of these literal things like evolution?
The question is, why doesn't the prophet go ask God? If they really have this access to God that is claimed, I mean, these guys aren't stuck just guessing in the dark. If they have access to God, they go and ask God. God, you know, did the flood of Noah really happen? Were Adam and Eve really the first human beings? You know, is organic evolution a reasonable explanation for the variety of species that we see today? Once abiogenesis had occurred, these are the kind of questions which the creator of the universe would know. And if he's really talking with Thomas S. Monson and stuff in the temple every Thursday in that special room with the Warren chair that nobody ever sits in except Christ or whatever the Mormon mythology is, well, why doesn't they just ask him? Why won't any of these prophets actually walk into the temple and screw up a little bit of courage and say, you know what, God? We got to know, is evolution true? You know, I mean, is it a true explanation, et cetera, et cetera? Go down the list of questions. And if you come back and say, well, it's not pertinent to our salvation, I have to say, bull friggin' crap. Obviously it is, because I can't take the church seriously because of this stuff. Okay? And I know a lot of people like me who have apostatized from the church because they look at a church making claims which we know are not true, and the church loses credibility, and the prophets, seers, and revelators have lost their credibility, and the scriptures have lost their credibility. I can't take these guys seriously because they say whatever they want, or at least they did in times past when they were willing to say anything at all, and all this stuff is proven false, and all we get for answers is just crap, and then pay, pray, and obey, and have you read your scriptures lately, and I'd be like, the last time I read my scriptures, I read a bunch of, Bronze Age mythology and not a whole lot of decent ethics or anything else. Isn't it important? I mean, if it was important to me that the church be credible, on this, then why would that not be pertinent to our salvation? I mean, according to Mormons, I'm not going to be saved in the celestial kingdom now because I've taken my garments off and I don't pay my tithing anymore and I don't believe in the church and I don't support Thomas S. Monson as a prophet, seer, and revelator and all the rest. So I'm giving up my salvation. So yeah, this is extremely important to my salvation. If the church is really true, I need to know this stuff so that I could take it seriously. And I know a ton of ex-Mormons and closet non-believers just like me for whom this is a major, major, major issue. And I simply can't accept that this is so unimportant that the prophets just don't even bother to ask God because, you know, duh, this is just so unimportant that why would he waste his time? This is of critical importance.
Okay, going back to your original question, Seth, number one, I can't remember the names, but at least one, I have a feeling that it was more than one, but I will just quote as being one. General authority stated that they leave science to the scientists and focus upon the spiritual aspects of the gospel, which is Christ and the atonement and our discipleship and so forth. So that is an answer to your question that...
No, it isn't.
It is.
That is a total avoidance of the question.
It's an answer to your question in that, as far as God, taking that literally, as far as God is concerned, our knowledge about the flood, Tower of Babel, the creation, and so forth, all of that will come through science, not through the church. The church leaders need to focus upon the gospel, which is the story of Christ and the atonement.
But you're flat out wrong.
No, I'm not wrong.
You're flat out wrong. The scriptures are full of the stuff that you're telling me the church is going to leave to science.
The scriptures are full of the stuff.
And the prophets, seers, and revelators are full of it in more ways than one. You know, I mean, Joseph Smith.
The scriptures are full of these stories, but the purpose, these stories are given for the purpose to teach faith in God and obedience to God. They're not given to teach us
the fact.
They're not given to teach the hows and whys of the flood or the hows and whys of the creation. They're given to teach us about faith in God. God is our parent. He's created the earth as our mortal home for his children and our obedience to him. So you look at the how, but don't look at the why. Leave that to the scientists. And this is an answer to your question in that they go to God, they pray, tell us about the flood, and he's telling them, in effect, don't worry about the flood. Leave that to the scientists. You focus upon Christ.
But that's totally wrong. The cat is already out of the bag because the prophets of old, before they got wise and stopped talking about stuff like that, they said all kinds of things about this. The scriptures said all kinds of things about this. Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and Parley P. Pratt and all these other, you know, former apostles and prophets, seers and revelators and all this other stuff. They had all kinds of stuff to say about the very topics which you are telling me now that they won't touch with a 10-foot pole because they're going to leave it to science, but the cat is already out of the bag. They already said this stuff. That's why they've lost their credibility. And you can't just say, oh, well, we're going to leave this to science. No, it's too late for that. They didn't leave it to science. They wrote it down and they spoke over the pulpit and they made all kinds of claims which have subsequently been proven untrue, and that's why they have no credibility in my mind, because they didn't leave it to science. They couldn't help themselves from opining about all kinds of stuff that now the apostles won't touch with a 10-foot pole.
Well, Seth,
and in so doing, they blew it. And you, it cats out of the bag, Dad.
I've already explained, Seth, that literally a revolution has occurred in the church in terms of focusing upon Christ like they do today versus focusing upon these various and sundry details like they used to do. Now, I hope that you'd give the church credit, including the general authorities, credit for making that type of a change over a span of a number of decades.
Well, I don't really give them credit because I don't think that they did it for a good reason. They did it because they had nothing else they could do.
Secondly, Seth, you live in the 21st century, the 20th and 21st century. You don't live in Brigham Young's time. Look at the church as it exists today. This is your time. You don't live back then. You didn't live back then. You live today. So look at the church today and look at the leaders of today and look at what the leaders of the church are saying today and whether or not that is important to you. They talk about Christ and you have to decide, is Christ important to me? Is his atonement important to me? Yay or nay? But
you know what they say to me?
forget about the church leaders, what they said in bringing monks time, because you don't live, you didn't live back then. You live today. Look at the church today. Get the church latitude to make a change from the apostles on down, to make a change in their viewpoint and the focus that they focus upon. And that today, in your time, they leave science to the scientists and they look at the spiritual aspect. And that's a good suggestion for you to follow.
You know what the apostles and prophets say to me today? I mean, you just said it. The church, I should look at the prophets and the apostles of today and listen to what they're saying. And you know what I hear from them? I hear pay, pray, and obey. And that's about it. These guys get up every 6 months and they read us the same old stuff. You know what I mean? You know, be good. Read your scriptures. Be faithful to the church. You know, don't touch your private parts unless you're married. And don't beat your wife. They say the same things every 6 months. And that's not to say that they don't say some wise stuff, but nothing that they're telling us these days is anything that normal, like virtuous, non-religious believers don't also tell us. I mean, there's nothing that these guys are telling us that couldn't have been invented by the mind of a good-natured and well-meaning human being. And as far as credibility of them speaking for God, well, there is none. And I'm not going to obey these guys. I see the whole pay, pray, and obey thing is kind of cultish. And I really don't want to say, oh, the Mormon church is a cult, because then, you know, Mormons will just stop listening. That's not what I mean. I mean, I think all religions are cults, if you want to use that word at all. But when they say obey the leaders, the first principle of heaven is obedience. Obey, 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 obey. I look at the whole world and the history of religions, and I see that as a gigantic red flag. When the focus and the first law of heaven and everything else is all about just rendering obedience to the guys who claim to be telling you, or who claim the right to tell you what to do on behalf of the creator of the entire universe, that is a gigantic red flag to me. So, and I think that history bears this out, because, you know, history is just riddled with people who got up and said, by the way, the creator of the universe appeared to me, and he has given me the right to tell you all what to do in his name. I mean, you can't deny that churches and religions and shamans and so forth have been doing that for thousands and thousands of years. It's almost literally the oldest, like, con in the book. And that's, you know, the dressed up, nice looking, well-groomed version of that is what we get in the Mormon church today, and not much more. It's, but anyway, sorry, that's my anti-testimony.
I've never heard a general authority say that the first principle is obedience. I've heard a lot of local leaders.
Well, Joseph Smith said it. Joseph Smith is supposed to have said the first principle of heaven is obedience. Well, or the first law of heaven or something like that.
Send me the reference by email so I can look at it. I personally believe that the first law of heaven is love, and that obedience comes as a result of love. Obedience without love is a cult. Obedience with love, obedience due to love is the way of God.
You're going to backpedal on this. I apologize.
No, Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. He didn't say keep my commandments. He says, if you love me, keep my commandments.
I'm apologizing to you in advance.
Obedience will come because of love.
You're going to be eating your words, and that's okay. I totally am going to understand, and I'm not even going to grind your face in it when you do. But Joseph Smith did actually say it. The first principle of heaven, or the first law of heaven, or something like that, is obedience. Send me the reference,
and I'll accept it if it's credible.
And you can't deny that that's been a pretty consistent theme throughout the church's history. I mean, obey.
I've never heard that on a general level from Salt Lake. I've heard it on a local level from bishops and priesthood leaders. I've always disagreed with it. I've always felt that love was first, and that obedience had to come due to love. Obey, if you love me, keep my commandments, the Savior said. If obedience without love means that we're robots, we're cults. Obedience because of love, we love the children first, we love the church first, we love the Lord first, and then we obey because of that love, then we can become devoted servants. But we have to have love before obedience. So send me the reference by email so I can look at it.
All right. And I just wanted to say, you said obedience without love or whatever is just a cult. I wanted to interrupt you and say, thou sayest, but I had to let you finish. But, yeah, I get that in after the fact. Yeah, you said it, man. Those are your words, not mine.
That's right.
Well, we have to wrap this up. Already this is probably going to have to get chopped into a couple of segments. I wanted to thank you for coming on to this podcast. And I wanted to thank you for more than that. I think it's pretty obvious that one of the things that contributed to my apostasy is my sort of openness of mind and willingness to engage ideas and not shrink back from them. And I cannot claim the credit for that myself. It's pretty obvious to me. You know, and it's been obvious to me for some time, but especially in this conversation, I think it's pretty obvious to everybody who hears this, that I probably have as open a mind as I do because you have as open a mind as you do, and that you have demonstrated a willingness to think outside the box, to sort of break with traditional ideas, to not have a shelf, to engage all of the things mentally that you recognized in the past as possibly presenting problems to your faith, that you were willing to engage those rather than shrink back and kind of avoid all the sticky issues. I mean, you wrote that book a few years back, you know, your, I don't know what it was, 50 or 60 pages or so with your ideas. You've got the website, you put your ideas out there, and you do seem to be willing to take pretty much anything and deal with it one way or the other. And whether I agree with your with the results of you dealing with it, at the very least, you haven't put me off or anybody else off and said, I'm just going to put this on the shelf and not think about it. You might put something off and say, well, we don't have the resolution to that now, and maybe we will in the future. But that's not really the same as putting it on the shelf, because you are thinking about it. And I want to thank you for that, because I think that I got my questioning mind and my willingness to engage things probably from you. And I'm kind of thinking back into my childhood, trying to wonder, you know, what aspect of how you guys raised me led me to have as questioning of a mind as I do. And I can't really put my finger on it, but I think it's pretty obvious that you had it first. I've just taken that willingness maybe a step further than you. And I'm not saying that to boast. I'm just saying you questioned and came up with answers and made the decision that your answers are going to conform to the prime directive that the church is true. And I did the same thing, except I didn't maintain that prime directive. And that probably explains the difference between us.
But I think your last statement there really summarizes it up. Now, I'm glad that both of us have had an open mind, and I think it's a compliment to both of us that we've had open minds, even though we've gone in different directions. I've gone the direction of an apologist. Taking my faith first, and then the open mind, rationalizing both viewpoints to try and merge them together into harmony. You've gone off in a different direction, and that's fine. That's the choice that you've made. But I think it is a compliment that we both have had, to some degree, open minds about it. I've enjoyed this conversation, Seth, and I've appreciated the invitation that you've given me to talk with you. I think it's been good for both of us to share ideas and to understand how each person feels about things. That shows my respect for you, and it shows your respect for me.
Well,
that's great.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dad, for saying that. Thanks again for, you know, agreeing to appear with me on this podcast and to discuss these issues. I wanted to just remind everyone of what I said at the beginning of this, that a lot of apostates and non-believers and stuff are afraid to discuss these things with their parents and their in-laws. And their family members and their friends and stuff in the church, for fear that they'll be ostracized. And I certainly don't feel that way at all. And I know that we can talk about this stuff, and I can even get pretty aggressive and just tell you I think your beliefs are full of crap or whatever, and that I'm still your son, and you don't reject me. And I really have no fear on that account. So thanks again. And everyone, thanks for tuning in to Mormon Expression. Once again, I'm happy to say the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. This has been Seth Lay. Thanking you for listening to Mormon Expression. And I'm signing off. Have a good one.
See you later, Seth.